Radio.
The Francis Effect. What a new pope means for the Catholic future. A talk by journalist John Allen Jr. Hosted by Catholic Youth Services Sydney and Australian Catholic University.
Thoughts about the Francis phenomenon, the hurricane that we have seen in the first 6 months of Francis's papacy. Then I'm going to try to sketch to you three long-term core trajectories, megatrends, if you like, that are currently at work in the Catholic Church, and try to suggest with the election of Francis, the election of the first Latin American pope, the first pope in the developing world, may mean in terms of where those trends are going to go under this papacy. And then I'll end with the final thought, and then we'll shift to questions. So this won't just be a monologue, it'll also be a conversation. Okay? That's the game plan. Let's start with some fleeting thoughts about the Francis effect. Of course, we just reached the six-month mark last Friday of Francis's papacy. On the papal plane, returning from Rio de Janeiro to Rome, among many other memorable things, Pope Francis said, and by the way, I was on that papal plane. Let me tell you this. Alitalia Flight 4001 from Rio de Janeiro to Rome, in many ways, was a forgettable experience. The seats were uncomfortable, the food was mediocre, but ladies and gentlemen, I will give it this, the in-flight entertainment was spectacular. One of the things Francis said during that airborne press conference was, you know, he said, it's true that I haven't done very much yet. And of course, what he meant was he understands he was elected on a reform mandate to clean up problems with the Vatican Bank and many other things. And although he's created commissions to study those problems, he hasn't actually implemented much reform. And so one understands what he means. Yet I would submit that this is one case in which papal infallibility does not apply. Because the truth is, Pope Francis has worked a miracle in these first 6 months. He has changed the public conversation about the Catholic Church. On March 12, 2013, the day before his election, as a media professional, I can guarantee you what the narratives were about Catholicism at that stage. The narratives were child sexual abuse crisis and Vatican Bank meltdowns and bruising political fights. And of course, none of those things have gone away. And yet today, the dominant public narrative about Roman Catholicism is charismatic pope takes world by storm. Now, if that is not a revolution, I'm not sure we've ever seen it. Okay? Now, let me flesh that out for you. Let's talk briefly about Francis' popular appeal, his media appeal, and how he's changing the culture in Rome. Popular appeal. Lots of different things we could talk about here, but let's focus on that Brazil trip for a moment. I mean, what you saw there was a kind of outpouring of enthusiasm for the Pope that was just remarkable. I mean, let's start with the fact I was in downtown Rio de Janeiro the day he went to the cathedral. Okay, his ostensible purpose for being there was to speak to a group of Argentinian youth, but of course everybody showed up. Do you remember what happened when the Pope Mobile pulled up at that cathedral? There was a group of several hundred nuns off to the side who, when the Pope pulled up, basically lost it. They rushed the Pope Mobile, screaming at the top of their lungs like teenage girls at a Justin Bieber concert. Okay? And I pulled aside one Brazilian cop because the Brazilians had turned out 20,000 security personnel to try to prevent this sort of storming of the Pope while he was on the ground. And I said to this guy, how come you didn't try to get in the way of the nuns as they were sort of, you know, rushing the Pope? And he said to me, hey man, I'm wearing a combat helmet, I've got ammo strapped to my vest, I do not want to be the guy on YouTube caught beating up a nun. Perfectly understand. Okay? But forget that for a moment. Think about those culminating events on his itinerary in Brazil. The youth vigil on Saturday, of course he was there for World Youth Day, the youth vigil on Saturday night on Copacabana Beach, and the mass the next morning, including mass of World Youth Day, in both cases turn out in excess of 3 million. By the way, shattering the previous attendance record at Copacabana Beach, which was set by the Rolling Stones in 2006. And let me tell you, from a media point of view, anytime you can put the Pope and Mick Jagger in the same sentence, you're cooking with gas. And in fact, that remarkable outpouring of humanity gave me the opportunity to write a lead paragraph in my own sort of rap piece about a bit of papal activity I never thought in my career I'd have the opportunity to write. And that paragraph was, for one hallowed weekend in late July, bikinis and rosaries were on the same side of the cultural divide, joining forces to welcome the Pope to the world's most famous stretch of sand and surf. Now, I guarantee in the media business, you don't often see opportunities to use language like that roll around very often, but there it was on display in Brazil. All right, that's the popular view. Media view. Again, many things we could talk about here, but here's my favorite example. Do you know that in June, the Italian edition of Vanity Fair magazine, Vanity Fair, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a diocesan newspaper somewhere, okay? But a secular sort of, you know, media outlet that has a checkered history, let's say, in terms of its approach to the Catholic Church. Vanity Fair declared Pope Francis its man of the year. Now, two things about that I find striking. One, in early June, the guy had been Pope for 2 months. 2 months! Okay, and they'd already decided that that merited the man of the year award. But even more so, think about this. It was June! There were 6 months left in calendar 2013. And yet they had decided that nothing anybody else was going to do for the rest of the year could possibly top what they had seen from Francis in the first 2 months. Okay? That's the media view. Finally, let's talk about him changing the culture in Rome. And again, here, there are many examples I could give you, but here's my favorite. I was in Rome. I went immediately after his election. I spent most of April in Argentina trying to do the backstory on the new Pope. And then late in April, I came back to Rome to spend some time there. And at one stage, I found myself in Trastevere, which is a neighborhood in Rome, and there's a kind of satellite Vatican down there, and many of the pontifical councils have their headquarters there. Went out to dinner with some friends of mine who work in the council for the family at a restaurant that a lot of Vatican people go to. And that particular night, there was a veteran Vatican cardinal who came in at one stage. This guy has been around since the dawn of time. Honest to God, I think he got his red hat from Pius the 11th. Okay, that's how long this cardinal has been in the scene. And typically he looks the part, dressed in a lot of ecclesiastical finery, right? But this particular night, he was dressed very simply, wearing just the kind of black clergyman outfit and no other ostentation. So jokingly, I said to him, "Your Eminence, what's up? I mean, you know, you look much simpler, less elaborate than you typically do." And he looked at me with a twinkle in his eye, and he said, "Well, John, what you must understand is that with this Pope, simple is the new chic." That's the Francis effect in action. Okay. So in terms of both public impression and the internal life of the church, in 6 short months, this has been nothing short of remarkable. However, of course, we also know that popes, however beguiling or charismatic they may be, are not the only actors on the Catholic scene. There are other members of this cast. In addition to which, the freedom of action of any pope, of any leader, is also constrained and shaped by the historical situation they inherit. So what I'd like to do now is sketch sort of three long-term trajectories or trends in Catholic life that I think shape the context in which Francis takes office in 2013. And then sort of tease out what the election of this particular pope might mean in terms of how those trajectories are going to unfold. Okay? And for those of you who are keeping score at home, most of this material comes from my 2009 book, The Future Church, if you want sort of more detail or elaboration on these trends. So let me give you three mega trends in Catholic life and what the election of Francis means. First mega trend, the rise of what I call a world church. A world church. Let me give you two different snapshots of the global Catholic population at two different moments in time. In the year 1900, at the dawn of the 20th century, there were 266 million Catholics in the world, of whom 200 million, that's two-thirds, 200 million lived in Europe and North America. Just 66 million everywhere else. They were principally in Latin America. This, of course, was before the population explosion of the 20th century. In other words, just a century ago, just 100 years ago, the ethnic and demographic profile of the Catholic Church was basically what it had been at the time of the Council of Trent. We were an overwhelmingly white, first world family of faith. Now, let's run the clock forward to the year 2000, the end of the 20th century. At that stage, there were 1.1 billion Catholics in the world, of whom 740 million lived in the Southern Hemisphere. Africa, Latin America, Asia, Oceania, the Middle East, and so on. The bulk, roughly 380 million, living in Europe and North America. To put that point differently, just 100 years ago, two-thirds of the Catholic population of this world lived in the developed world. They lived in what we call the West. 100 years later, two-thirds lived in the global south, in the developing world. And if we project forward to the middle of this century, the year 2050, the projection is that by that stage, the share of the Catholic population that will live in the developing world will be three-quarters. In other words, within the arc of the lifetimes of most people in this room, three out of every four Catholic men, women, and children alive will live outside the West. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the most rapid, most sweeping, most profound transformation of Catholic demography in more than 2,000 years of church history, and we are living through it right now. To give you a sense of significance, I would submit to you that this is equivalent in importance to that moment in the first century when St. Paul left Palestine to travel to Greece and Rome, thereby transforming early Christianity from a sect within Palestinian Judaism to a new religious movement in the ancient Greco-Roman world. Okay, we are living through a moment of organic change in Catholicism that is mammoth in importance. When I was in graduate school, I had a history professor who once claimed that he could write a history of the world in one sentence. He said if somebody put a gun to his head and forced him to do that, the sentence he would write is, first the agricultural revolution happened, and then the industrial revolution. So in terms of import, those were the two most important developments. Well, similarly, if you put a gun to my head and say, write me a history of the Catholic Church in the 20th century, my sentence would be, the center of gravity shifted from north to south. Now, many other important things happened during the 20th century. You know, we had the pontificate of Pius XII, we had the Second Vatican Council, we had John Paul II, and on, and all worthy chapters. But in terms of monumental importance for shaping the Catholic culture of our day, I would suggest that shift from north to south towers above everything else. It is the Catholic story of our time. Now, what does all that mean? Well, first of all, let me give you a warning. I mean, if somebody stands in front of you and tries to peddle you generalizations about 740 million people, you probably want to be a little cautious, huh? Because for any generalized statement I can give you about Catholicism in the global south, there are literally millions, if not tens of millions, of exceptions. But let me give you one. My experience, 20 years of covering the global Catholic story, is that in general, the interests of the church in the global south tend to be more odd extra than odd intra. That is, they're more interested in the church's engagement with the wider world than they are with insider Catholic baseball. So if you stop the typical Catholic in Africa or Latin America or Asia, and you ask them, what are the big issues facing the church? They're not generally going to come up with the kind of insider stuff that those of us in the West sometimes fasten on. Things like, how should we translate liturgical texts into English? Or, you know, who gets appointed bishops and how? And I mean, not that those things aren't important, but my experience of talking to bishops, theologians, clergy, lay activists, rank and file, ordinary mass-going Catholics in the global south, left to their own devices, if you ask them to tick off the things that are of greatest importance to them, what they perceive to be the key issues facing the church, you're typically going to hear three things above them. One, you will hear about migrants, refugees, immigrants, people on the move. Two, you will hear about poverty. And three, you will hear about war and peace. Those are the three great issues that Catholics in the global south typically want to see their church engage. What does the election of a pope from the developing world mean vis-a-vis that agenda? I would suggest to you that Francis is profoundly conscious. As the first Latin American pope, the first pope from the developing world, he sees himself as a tribune and a spokesperson for that agenda. My proof would be, let's look at what we've seen from Francis in terms of substantive concerns during his first 6 months. What was his first trip outside Rome? It was not actually the trip to Brazil. His first trip outside Rome came on July 8th. It was to the southern Mediterranean island of Lampedusa, which is the major gathering point for immigrants from Africa and the Middle East who are attempting to reach Europe. It's an island considered part of Sicily in terms of Italian jurisdiction. There is a major housing facility for refugees there. It is also, most of the people who wash up in Lampedusa literally wash up there. They have taken a very perilous boat crossing across the Mediterranean to try to get there. And an estimated 20,000 people have died trying to make that crossing. Pope Francis intentionally wanted to go to Lampedusa to memorialize those who have died and to denounce what he called on that day the globalization of indifference. to migrants and refugees. It was the most pointed political commentary of his papacy to date. And he clearly chose to make that his first outing, to make it his sort of tone-setting, if you like, public debut, because he wanted to put that issue on the agenda. All right, that's migrants and refugees. Poverty. Go back to Brazil. You may know that the schedule for Francis's trip to Brazil was actually set when Benedict was still pope. Okay? Francis made two additions to it. One, he chose to go to the shrine of Our Lady of Aparecida, the patroness of Brazil, because he's a strong believer in Latin American popular religiosity. The other is, he asked for the opportunity to visit one of the favelas, the slums, in Rio de Janeiro. He went to a slum called Virginia, which is one of the most infamous, notorious slums in Brazil, hotbed of gang violence and so on. And he went there precisely because he wanted to be able to stand in front of the poorest of the poor, the most neglected, marginalized, and forgotten strata of Brazilian society, and be able to deliver to them a very simple message. He stood there that day in a soccer field in the middle of this slum, in the midst of pouring rain. The weather was god-awful. Much like tonight here in the city. He stood there in that spot, and he looked at these people who have been failed by every other institution in their experience, and he said to them, brothers and sisters, the church is with you. The church is with you. Remember, of course, this is the Pope, 3 days after his election, who said that his dream was of a poor church for the poor. It was in Virginia that day where that dream took on flesh and bone in the person of the Holy Father himself standing there to deliver that message. My experience is the message got through. I was in the press pool for that event, so I was there in that driving rain, you know, for 3 hours waiting for the Pope to show up. And after he got there and did his thing, I was doing a little vox pop. And there was this one guy who came up to me who obviously was animated and wanted to say something, so he started talking. He began with some indigenous dialect I had no comprehension of. When he figured out I wasn't understanding that, he shifted to Portuguese, which my Portuguese is incredibly rudimentary, so it became clear to him I wasn't getting that either. So he then shifted to what you do in these situations where, you know, you're speaking, you don't have a language in common, which is you go to hand gestures, right? So he started doing this gesture, and I figured out what he meant was he was referring to the slum, right, the place he lived. Right? So he was doing this, and I got, okay, you mean the favela? And he gave the thumbs down, okay? He didn't like the place he lived. Then he pointed to the Pope standing up at the dais, and he gave me the thumbs up. Okay, like, I like this guy. Basically, translation, slum bad, Pope good, okay? And this was basically the vox pop on that date. My point is the Pope's message got through. War and peace. The definitional, if you like, geopolitical and diplomatic initiative of Pope Francis in recent weeks has been the effort to engage the mounting crisis in Syria. And he has become, in effect, the leader of the moral opposition in the world to the idea of Western-led military strikes in Syria. Much like 10 years ago, John Paul II was the chaplain of the moral opposition to the US-led war in Iraq. Once again, Francis has pulled out all the stops. As you know, he called a global day of prayer and fasting for peace in Syria on September 7th, led himself a four-hour prayer service in St. Peter's Square. He asked all of the ambassadors accredited to the Holy See to come in for a special briefing in which Vatican diplomats had the opportunity to lay out the moral case against the use of force in Syria. Rarely has an opportunity gone by when he has been in public since the Syria crisis erupted that he hasn't somehow engaged it, including, by the way, a communications tool that was not open to John Paul II 10 years ago, which is he's been sending out anti-war tweets, very 21st century Pope. This has become the kind of hallmark signature sort of diplomatic initiative under Francis, and it's organized around the idea of opposition to conflict and promotion of peace. So I said a moment ago, the defining concerns of activist Catholicism in the global south are immigration, poverty, war, and peace. I don't think it is any accident that they have also become the definitional sort of social and political concerns of this papacy in its embryonic stage. All right, that's the rise of the world church. Let me give you a second megatrend in Catholic life. The rise of what I call evangelical Catholicism. Evangelical Catholicism. And here, of course, I'm borrowing a term from our Protestant brothers and sisters and sort of translating it back into a Catholic context. In a nutshell, the spirit of evangelical Catholicism is trying to revive the missionary energies of the church, trying to make it a more effective, more credible, more meaningful missionary agent, which is at one level and in one part about trying to invite people to explicit belief in Christ and explicit membership in the church. At another level, in another sense, it is also about the broader missionary agenda of trying to transform the world from the inside out in the spirit of the gospel. Now, in a sense, this evangelical thrust in Catholic life has always been latent in the church, but I think many observers of the Catholic landscape would say somewhere along the line in the post-Vatican II period, some of those missionary fires went out. We became more concerned with the maintenance of institutions and so on than the core missionary enterprise of redeeming the world in the light of Christ. And so today's emphasis, expressed in signature fashion in the project put on the agenda by John Paul II and Benedict XVI of a new evangelization, is precisely about trying to revive these missionary energies. Now, I would say there were sort of two pillars to this enterprise. One is a recovery of traditional Catholic identity, clarity about who we are, because obviously you can't evangelize if you don't first know the proposition we're trying to put on the world's table. And the second is sort of getting out of the sacristy and into the street, taking this message into the postmodern marketplace. I would submit that the contribution of Francis, or the significance of his election, is that if the energies of the church were largely concentrated on that recovery of identity bit, in some ways, during the late John Paul and Benedict years, what we have under Francis is we are clearly now in phase two, okay, which is the getting out of the sacristy and into the street, relighting the missionary fires. And I think, in part, that is a concrete reflection of his experience as a pastor in Latin America. Because what the Catholic Church in Latin America has learned the hard way over the last generation is that the "if you build it, they will come" model of Catholic life is no longer sustainable in the 21st century. That is, simply opening the doors of the church and counting on people's residual Catholicity to bring them in is no longer viable. Do you know that more people have converted from Catholicism to Protestantism in Latin America over the last 25 years than did so in Europe in the century following the Protestant Reformation? It is the most significant religious realignment of our lifetime. The Latin American bishops did a study in the mid-1990s in which they concluded that they were losing 8,000 people every day to Protestantism. Some evangelicals, mostly Pentecostals, but that's 8,000 people every day, day in, day out, 7 days a week, you know, 365 days a year. Massive, massive defections. And in large part, this is because the church failed to, and this is the conclusion they have drawn, failed to deliver the basic pastoral care that would have invited people who had been born Catholic, communicated to them that they still had a faith home inside the church. Let me tell you a quick story that in microcosm tells you the story of what's happening in Latin America. I was in Honduras not long ago, and I met a woman who was the last Catholic in her family. Everyone else is converted to the Pentecostals. And this, by the way, is one of the traditional 500 families in Honduras that can trace their roots back to the conquistadors, right? The kind of culture-setting families in the country. So obviously I was curious as to what happened, and I asked her, well, why has everyone else in your family left the Catholic Church? Here's the story she told me. A few years ago, the matriarch of the clan, the woman who sort of set the tone for the family, had gone into the hospital with brain cancer. She was in the hospital for about a year before she finally died. Now, during that year she was hospitalized, her parish priest got in to see her exactly twice. And by the way, folks, this is not because the guy was lazy or didn't care. I mean, we in the West complain about priest shortages. You know what the priest-to-Catholic ratio is in Europe and North America? It's 1 to 1,300. Okay, we have one Catholic priest over 1,300 baptized Catholics. Do you know what it is in Latin America? It's 1 to 7,800. However bad you may think the priest shortage is in your backyard, I am here to guarantee you there are spots on the Catholic map where it was infinitely worse. So the typical parish priest in Latin America is not only responsible for one of these mega parishes, but he's also probably teaching a half load of the seminary, he's probably moderating a half dozen lame movements, and he's probably responsible for 8, 10, 12 satellite parishes out in the hills. So my point is that this guy, his failure to show up more regularly at the hospital was not a lack of pastoral concern, he simply didn't have the time. This was an ostensibly Catholic hospital, but for the same reason there was no resident Catholic chaplain. So functionally speaking, for the year this woman was hospitalized, the Catholic Church was invisible to her. Meanwhile, the ladies from the local Pentecostal church were in her hospital room every day. Okay. They were praying the Bible with her. They were holding her hand when he got her chemo treatments. They were cleaning her up afterwards. They were going back to her house to make sure the lawn was mowed and the kids stayed out of gangs and her husband stayed off of booze. And I don't think it's any surprise that at some point in that experience, she decided she felt more comfortable in that Pentecostal church than she did in her Catholic Church of Origin. She converted pretty much her entire family followed her. You multiply that story by 10,000 times, 100,000 times, a million times. That's the story of what's going on in Latin America today. Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the man we now know better as Pope Francis, knows that story in his bones. He's lived it. And he understands that if the Catholic Church does not revive its missionary energies, then we are destined to replicate that story over and over again, and it will not be confined simply to Latin America. And I don't think his concern is as a craftsman about market shares or numbers, but I think he believes that the Catholic Church has a profoundly important message to deliver to the postmodern world, and he doesn't want to see it slide into irrelevance. So the commitment he brings to the Church's missionary enterprise comes out of that. His favorite saying, the thing he was famous for in Argentina, as Archbishop of Buenos Aires, is that the Catholic Church cannot stay too long in the sacristy. If we stay in the sacristy, breathing that stale air, the church is going to get sick. In order to be healthy, it has to be out in the street where people live. That was his spirit in Buenos Aires, and I believe he's bringing that spirit to the papacy, and again, it reflects the experience as a pastor that's propelled into this point. All right, final megatrend in Catholic life. And this is one that was not on my radar screen when I did the book The Future Church in 2009, but it has emerged with crystal clarity in the period since. The rise of religious freedom as the signature social and political concern of the Catholic Church in the 21st century. And that's important enough, I want to repeat it. The rise of religious freedom as the premier social and political concern of the Catholic Church in the early 21st century. Now, when I say that, I have in mind, in part, some of the religious freedom struggles that we have in the West. In the United States, you may know, for example, that the Catholic bishops of the United States have been involved in a kind of high-stakes game of poker with the Obama White House over contraception mandates that have been imposed as part of the healthcare overhaul. There are similar problems in other parts of the West as well. Those issues are going to grow in intensity and in number. They're going to continue to be part of the landscape. But when I tell you that religious freedom has become the new social and political ite fix of Catholicism in the 21st century, that is not primarily what I have in mind. Instead, primarily what I have in mind are the far more harrowing, far more dramatic, far more urgent challenges to religious freedom in a growing number of other parts of the world. Let me put it to you in a soundbite and then I'll unpack it. In the West, a threat to your religious freedom means that you might get sued. In many other global neighborhoods today, a threat to your religious freedom means that you might get shot. And I suspect all of us could agree that that rate's slightly higher on the urgency meter. Right? Let me give you three bits of data. Because this landscape of challenges to religious freedom in many ways claims Christians as its primary victims. Three bits of data. One, according to the International Society for Human Rights in Frankfurt, Germany, which, by the way, is not a church outfit. This is a secular NGO that tracks human rights issues. According to the International Society for Human Rights, 80%, that's 80% of the violations of religious freedom in the world today are directed against Christians. Statistically speaking, Christians are by far, by some order of magnitude, the world's most persecuted religious body. Second bit of data, from the Pew Forum, again, not a church outfit, but the most widely respected institution on religion and public policy in Washington, D.C. According to the Pew Forum, Christians suffer some form of persecution or harassment in 137 countries. Again, bear in mind, there are a grand total of 193 on the global stage. That means there is some form of anti-Christian persecution in almost 3 out of every 4 countries on Earth. And in the most bone-chilling bit of data of all, according to the Center for the Study of Global Christianity, which is a Protestant outfit located in the state of Massachusetts, it's the only think tank that has done any kind of quantitative study of Christian martyrdom. According to the Center for the Study of Global Christianity, on average, for each of the last 10 years, there have been 100,000 Christians killed for the faith in what they call a situation of killed for the faith every year. 100,000 new martyrs every year for each single year of the last decade. What that means, ladies and gentlemen, is that roughly in the hour we are going to be together here tonight, somewhere on this planet, 11 Christians are losing their lives. We are witnessing, in the early 21st century, the emergence of an entire new generation of Christian martyrs on a scale that, historically speaking, has never been seen before. This is by far, in my estimation, the most compelling Christian narrative of our time, and it is in many ways also the most untold Christian story of our time. If you want to put some flesh and blood on those statistics, I would direct your attention to the situation with the church in Iraq. Do you know that in 1991, prior to the first Gulf War, there were an estimated 1.5 to 2 million Christians in Iraq? It was the second largest Christian community in the Middle East after Egypt. It's also a church that could trace its roots back to the era of the apostles. Okay? As of today, the high-end estimate for the number of Christians left in Iraq is about 400,000. Realistically, most people believe it's closer to 200,000 to 250,000. Most of those Christians have gone into exile, but a staggering number of them have been killed. For example, what happened at the Church of Our Lady of Salvation in downtown Baghdad on October 31st, 2010. In itself, the fact that the church was bombed that day is no novelty. Of the 63 Christian churches in Iraq, 40 of them have been bombed at least once since 2003. But what followed was unusual, because what followed was a group of armed Islamic gunmen stormed the church. They killed the priest saying mass, they killed the two deacons assisting him, they killed 33 other people, leaving 36 dead, and they held the church for the 6 hours it took the Iraqi Defense Forces to show up and liberate. Now, shortly after that happened, I had the opportunity to interview one of the survivors, a young Chaldean Catholic woman by the name of Fatima, who's now in Rome. She was singing in the choir that day. The way she survived, the choir mate to her left and the choir mate to her right were both shot dead. The way she survived was by falling to the floor and pulling their bodies over her and playing dead for the agonizing 6 hours it took for someone to come to her rescue, thinking every instant one of these guys was going to walk by and deliver the coup de grace. Now, as I mentioned, she now lives in Rome. She's devoted her every waking moment to helping her fellow Christians get out of Iraq because she's profoundly convinced they have no future there. Now, you know, one hopes she's wrong, but it is impossible to fault the reasoning or the experience that's led her to that conclusion. And that, ladies and gentlemen, in miniature, is the Christian experience of our time in an increasing number of places in this world. It tends to be Christians in the developing world, in the world's most dangerous neighborhoods, who bear the brunt of this rising wave of violations of religious freedom, this rising wave of persecution and assault on the basis of one's faith. I submit to you that the first pope from the developing world is going to feel a special historical and providential obligation to be a voice and a face for the concerns and the suffering of this Christian population. And again, I think it is no accident that he has fastened upon Egypt and Syria as being his sort of core issues of diplomatic interest, because those are the places on the global map today where Christians are most at risk. Christians both in Syria and Iraq are profoundly convinced that they may be, or both in Syria and Egypt, are profoundly convinced they may be the next Iraq. Francis has heard their voices, and I believe he is going to become a carrier of their agenda. All right, let's try to bring this plane in for a landing. A final thought. Okay. I have sketched the exciting developments of the first 6 months of this papacy. I have also sketched, I think you would agree, some challenging and in some ways troubling trajectories in Catholic life. And I would submit to you that if we are going to respond to those trajectories successfully, we're going to need a kind of whole cocktail of qualities and heart and mind to see us through these challenges. Because, of course, responding effectively to these challenges, the rise of the world church, the rise of evangelical Catholicism, the rise of religious freedom is a signature concern. Yes, Francis can provide leadership, but he can't do the whole job. I mean, we all have to be involved in trying to summon our best energies to respond creatively. And if we're going to do that, we're going to need many qualities. We're going to need perseverance. We're going to need creativity. We're going to need fidelity. We're going to need imagination. But I guarantee you this, ladies and gentlemen, there is one other quality of heart and mind that has to be in this mix. It is a sine qua non. If we do not possess this quality of heart and mind, we will not rise to the occasion of these challenges. We will be steamrolled by them. And that quality of heart and mind is we're going to need a lively sense of humor. Because if we can't occasionally laugh at ourselves and our circumstances, we are going to spend the balance of the 21st century fighting down heartburn. And the good news to you folks is that you can find that lively sense of humor in the Catholic Church, even sometimes in the most wildly improbable places. And I want to tell you one last anecdote to drive that point home, and then we'll see what questions you have. Anecdote is this. You may remember that 2005 was kind of a busy time in the Vatican newsbeat. Okay, we had the twilight of John Paul's papacy, then his death on April 9th at 9:37 p.m. local Rome time. Then we had that tidal wave of humanity that washed through Rome in the aftermath. The city of Rome estimates that somewhere between 5 and 10 million people came through Rome in those days to pay their respects to the Pope. The drama of the election of the new Pope and all of that. You remember that? Well, you all here down under, I know, are media savvy enough to appreciate this point. If there is one thing that follows a major news event, as surely as night follows day, it is that there will be a cottage industry of Instabooks looking to cash in and all that energy, right? And so there was a cottage industry of Instabooks about the death of John Paul and the rise of the new Pope. And the way I know that, ladies and gentlemen, is that I participated in that cottage industry. I produced my own Instabook called The Rise of Benedict XVI. Now, there is a tradition in the Vatican Press Corps that when one of us writes a book about the Holy Father, we always inscribe a copy to him, you know, dedicate the book to him. And then we give it either to his priest secretary or his spokesperson or whoever to be passed on to him. Now, to be honest with you, it had never entered my mind for a nanosecond that the Pope would actually read these books. Okay? In my mind's eye, I had pictured a box in the basement of the Apostolic Palace where they all kind of gathered dust, right? Anyway, Pope is elected in April. I write my Instabook in May. It comes out June 1st. I dutifully inscribe a copy to Benedict XVI. I gave it to Joaquin Navarro Valls, the Spanish layman, who at the time was still the Holy Father's spokesperson, and I promptly forgot about it. Flash forward to August, my wife and I have gone back to the United States for a vacation. We're out in a very small western Kansas farm town where my, at that stage, 93-year-old grandma lives. Okay? This town, by the way, is my candidate for the worst place name in America. It's called Hill City. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no hill, and there sure as hell is no city. Okay? We're talking about 400 people on a good day. All right? But there we are in Hill City, America. And my cell phone goes off. And you know how your cell phones, even back in, you know, the mists of prehistory in 2005, even then, right, you know, your cell phone tells you who's called, right? So I could tell it was Joaquin Navarro Valls on the phone. And by the way, I can't prove this to you empirically, but I am morally convinced this is the first time in recorded history that a call was ever placed from the papal household to Graham County, Kansas. Because I can think of no other circumstances in which such a thing might have happened. Anyway, Navarro was called. And he says to me, well, John, I wanted you to know, I'm with the Pope on vacation. Benedict was taking a vacation up in the northern Italian Alps. So Navarro Hall says, I wanted you to know, I'm with the Pope on vacation. And he came down this morning to breakfast with your book in his hands. And he asked me to pass along to you a message. I don't know about you, but if you've just been told the Pope has a personal reaction to something you've written about him, I would want to be sure your tray table is in a full upright locked position, you know, because the sky might get a little bumpy. But, you know, so I say to Joaquin, well, of course, I'm delighted. You know, please, what's the Holy Father's message? Now, to get this, you need to understand, my book was divided into thirds, okay? So the first third were the final days of John Paul II. The middle third was the inside story of how Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger had been elected as Benedict XVI. And then the final chunk of the book was my projections for where his papacy was going to go. Okay? So, Navarro says, well, the Holy Father's message was the following. He said, please thank Herr Dr. Allen for having written this book, particularly the last third about the future of my papacy, because it has saved me the trouble of thinking about it for myself. I like to think he was kidding. Ladies and gentlemen, I would suggest on this score at least, we ought to take our cues from the Holy Father. I think if we can take a clear-eyed, unflinchingly realistic look at the challenges we face, and not shrink from the mammoth investment of effort that it's going to take to respond creatively to them. But if we can do that with a twinkle in our eye rather than anger in our hearts and bile in our spleen, then that, ladies and gentlemen, is a successful strategy for the new evangelization. It is a successful strategy for Catholic life in the 21st century. If I can use this American idiom, every day of the week and twice on Sunday. Okay? Thank you. God bless you. God bless the Australian Catholic University. Viva!
That was John Allen Jr. with The Francis Effect, what a new pope means for the Catholic future. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.